Hello, welcome to Artbreaker, the premiere show of the Climactic Collective that holds space for the intersection of the art we make and the times we're in. Or, put another way, how the climate crisis informs and affects human creativity. This episode is courtesy of Saltgrass, a radio show from Castlemaine in central Victoria, from creator Alison Hanley. The artist featured in this episode is Jess Boylan, a photographer, among other disciplines, and the piece, The Smallest Measure, is discussed and explored. While a photography exhibition, you'll also hear some of the accompanying sound work. Additional music is courtesy of Melbourne NARM-based band, The General Assembly, with an instrumental of their aptly titled, Cape Grim. This episode does touch on the colonial history of Tasmania, massacres, and the word suicide, to name a place rather than the act. Please be aware of this if you are a traditional owner, or not feeling up to uses of that word. If you feel any distress and need to seek help, please feel no hesitation to do so. You can reach Lifeline New Zealand at Lifeline 0800 54 33 54 or free text HELP 4357. If you're in Australia, reach Lifeline at 131114. For more of the excellent Saltgrass podcast and radio show, please find links in the show notes.
Welcome to Saltgrass, a show about how local communities can engage with the climate crisis at a grassroots level. The program explores the unique challenges and advantages of working for change in regional communities and small towns, yet the themes are universal in an age where the main challenge of our times is how to navigate the imminent threat of a warming globe. This week, we're talking to Jessie Boylan about her PhD thesis and upcoming art installation that is part of the Castlemaine State Festival. Her work has taken her out into the wilds of a remote outpost at the edge of Tasmania, a place called Cape Grim, where there is a science lab that tests the air coming in off the ocean there. Without land or human habitation for hundreds of kilometres, the air blowing in off the ocean to Cape Grim is considered the best air in the world to get a base measurement for the quality of our atmosphere. Carbon and other greenhouse gases, amongst other things, are tested to see how the world's atmosphere is faring. Her artwork, her life as an activist, documentary photographer, and her work around the slow emergency that is climate change are all topics covered in our chat for this episode. Before we hear from Jessie Boylan, artist at Cape Grim, and her atmospheric scientists, I would like to acknowledge that Saltgrass is produced on Jarra Country, home of the Jarjarung people. Jessie and I both live on Jarra Country, and we pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging.
Salt of the earth people, grassroots change, saltgrass.
Listen to all episodes of Turning the Goldfields Green at saltgrasspodcast.com. Now, for those of you who don't live in central Victoria, the Castlemaine State Festival is a major arts event in our region. It happens every 2 years and has happened since 1976. The town squeezes art, performance, music and theatre into every nook and cranny. Right from the start, the festival set about to bring major artists and works to the region, and in doing so really helped cement Castlemaine and surrounds as a cultural powerhouse in regional Victoria. We also have a fabulous Fringe Festival that runs alongside it, which showcases local and emerging art as well. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed the shape and nature of the State Festival this year, with the international acts unable to travel and venues having limited numbers allowed. So many of the performances and events are outdoors or will have a limited audience. Boylan's long-standing interest in our symbiotic relationship with the environment has never been more pertinent. The artist uses photography, video and sound to explore the consequential social and psychological upheaval. I went to Jessie's studio to find out more about this work. Nestled at the bottom of a garden, her studio is fascinating. Bookshelves full of books I instantly wanted to browse through on human rights issues, photography, art, climate and philosophy. Shelves of camera lenses and parts, as well as framed artwork and objects from her travels and adventures. Her current thoughts and questions were pinned up onto the wall in post-it notes, with phrases to help her navigate her thesis and explore the themes of slow emergency and climate change. We sat down to begin, with my dog Bobby lying in the sun, coming through her windows. I started by asking her how long she spent down in Tassie at Cape Grim.
Just 5 days walking around the outside of the Cape Grim station. It's also called Kennanook in the local language.
How do you describe yourself as an artist?
I describe myself as a photography, video and sound artist who uses these mediums to explore environmental and social justice themes primarily, coming from a documentary photography background, but moving much more into an installation kind of space now. And I work a lot in collaboration with others, which is really important to me as well.
And you're currently studying a PhD. Where are you studying that?
Yeah, I'm doing a PhD at RMIT in the School of Art. And my topic is around how to use art, or how art can be part of a conversation to address slow climate emergencies and extinction and mass extinctions. And it's obviously that's a huge topic. So I'm trying to use one angle, which is to investigate this air monitoring station at Cape Grim and to look at the kind of ways in which air and atmosphere, I can use those kind of aspects to talk about these bigger global issues. So just focusing on kind of one, obviously it's a huge topic that I've gone into, but using one site as a kind of a springboard to talk about bigger issues.
Reflecting on your topic, it's the idea of this slow emergency is in comparison to, say, a natural disaster, which is an immediate emergency. But the slow emergency is climate change, and it's what people are now calling the climate emergency. I do think it's really hard to communicate to people who haven't taken the time to investigate it or think about it too much and maybe don't want to think about it. It's really hard to communicate that this emergency is still an emergency, even though it's really slow.
Slow emergencies are kind of, you know, there's this kind of fairly new field of research around slow emergencies. These kind of forms of harm and damage, which are continuously happening, and they're kind of happening out of sight, and they're kind of happening on a slow scale and of kind of pervasive yet subtle ways. And it's not just in climate change, like obviously things like family violence and intergenerational trauma and systemic racism, these things are also slow emergencies. But, you know, my area is around slow climate emergencies. So we think about deforestation. Whilst they're happening, you might not see the gradual effects until there's a kind of a rupture. You know, like we kind of respond when there are ruptures like bushfires and earthquakes. But the things that are perpetually happening, pesticides seeping into riverbanks and the gradual buildup of what these things do to both people and land and country and animals. And so to try and visualize or communicate something that is out of sight yet perpetually happening is quite a challenge. And for me, that's an exciting challenge. Generally with my work, I'm not trying to go, you must think this or you must feel this and then you must have this response. Trying to have other avenues for people to come in and engage with something. Maybe it's affectively or through emotion. And then how they respond to that work is kind of what they take from it, not necessarily prescribed by me or they have to have a certain outcome.
It sounds like you have spent the majority of your adult life as an activist as well as making art and following your inclinations towards filmmaking and photography. And I feel like activism, and it's something I come up against in my interviews, a lot of activism is sort of very blunt tools where it's like trying to hit people over the head with knowledge and like, if they just understood, they'd get it, or trying to say you're a bad person if you don't get it, that sort of thing. And I think that really can turn a lot of people off and make them just stop listening. And some activism is very effective. I'm not saying it's not. But I think at the opposite extreme is sometimes art can be too subtle or only a small audience sees it. So how do you feel about art as a means of communicating this stuff to people?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's that big question of being an artist in, and you know, having kind of political agenda or ideas that are about communicating particular issues, which is like, how do you know if it's effective or how do you know if it's reaching anyone? And I think that obviously there are measuring tools in which you can implement into your exhibition processes where you do community engagement processes and you don't show things only in white boxes and you try and find avenues to show works outside of those spaces, or you actively invite people into those spaces, or you make public shows, or you do surveys that engage with people about how they respond to those particular works, or have community who are affected by it engaged in those processes either from the beginning so that they know that that stuff is happening and they feel involved. I think you can only hope that you're another voice in the story, and to have multiple voices telling these stories, I think, is a good thing, because you have different sectors of society adding to this conversation. And the more voices that are out there talking about these things, I think obviously means the more people are going to see those things. And you can only rely on feedback, really, and trying to actively kind of engage with particular campaigns, like in my previous work, kind of anti-nuclear movement or conversations that broaden out the scope of what the role of art is. And it can often play a role alongside a campaign to form another way of engaging with that story. And in this context, actually engaging scientists who might not necessarily otherwise see or engage with art. And so also going, how can we have a conversation through this process? And I don't normally engage with science on that kind of level. You know, I use it all the time in terms of my understanding of the world, but I don't go into the micro and macro detail of air particles and what that means, you know? And so there's this conversation that's happening which allows both them into this conversation and me and us into that one.
Why don't you describe this particular project that we'll be showing at the Castle Mayne State Festival, which opens on the 19th of March, 2021. And it'll be showing at the Goods Shed, which is a big cavernous kind of building right next to the train line in Castle Mayne. Can you explain to the listener what the project is and how you formulated it and what they'll be able to experience if they go in there?
The amount of CO2 in the atmosphere has reached its highest level in at least 800,000 years. That's a view of the CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology. The organisations have released their latest climate snapshot, predicting global temperatures could rise by 5 degrees by 2070. Environment reporter Connor Duffy reports from Cape Grim in Tasmania.
The technicians arrive early to continue work that's been underway since this monitoring station was set up in the 70s. Dr. Paul Fraser has been here from the beginning, helping to establish what's become a sacred site for climate science.
Well, we like to think it's probably the most important site in the world. Other people may argue about that.
So exploring the Cape Grim Air Monitoring Station in northwest Tasmania, I'm using that as my main focal point, and also the CSIRO headquarters of Oceans and Atmosphere in Aspendale in Victoria, which is where a lot of the scientists who work at Cape Grim are often based. And they've got the air archive there, which we can talk about.
Yeah, tell us what that is.
Well, they've been storing air, collecting and storing air from Cape Grim since 1976. So they've got this historical archive.
That means every year that I've been alive, they've got a bottle of air, multiple bottles of air from that year.
Yep, exactly.
It's amazing.
And back then it was, you know, in terms of CO2 in the atmosphere, it was 330 parts per million, right? And now we're at 410 or 415. And so there's like this concept of what was life like in 90, what was the air quality? What was like, what was human activity like in 1976? And for me, it conjures up imagination. It conjures up kind of, where were we at? You know, and already back then, people knew what burning fossil fuels would do. And so, yeah, I'm using these two sites as a way to talk about air, this invisible substance, which is air, and how it affects all of us globally, you know, human and beyond human, and how we're connected by this substance, which we need to survive, and yet perpetually, slowly damaging the thing that we also need to survive. And so in this kind of process of organisms supporting one another, we're doing this process where we're actually destroying something which supports us. And I'm trying to speak to these ideas. At the moment, it's observational. It's observing the site at Cape Grim, which is a really interesting site. It's It's also called Kenanook, which is in the local language there.
Do you know what the cool people were called?
The Pierapa, but there's a few different clans that were there. So it's not just the Pierapa people, but a few different ones. And obviously lots of Tasmanian Aboriginal history. There's a lot being done now about renaming sites, and there's heaps around Cape Grim, around the sites there. So all the places, like there's a site there where the massacre was called Suicide Bay, which was in 1828, I think, 30 Aboriginal men were pushed off during the Black Wars. They called it Suicide Bay.
Because people got murdered there?
Yeah, which is horrific. And, of course, they've got other names for those sites. Yeah. I got to meet a woman, traditional owner from that area, who took me out to Suicide Bay to welcome me there. I wanted to make sure that while I was there I wasn't filming things that I shouldn't do. And obviously it's a very dark and sad history that's caught up with the air monitoring station there. So it's got these layers of history that are really interesting and tragic and awful, but also incredibly stunning and beautiful. And there's a lot of strength and stories about what people did living there, like in this kind of rugged and wild that gets very windy to the point where you can't open your car doors and everything's shaking, the camera's shaking, and the seas get very intense and rough. And yeah, stories of women crossing the bay to go and hunt mutton birds and swimming back again. And so it's a very interesting site. And so there are these like interweaving histories, which are about this air that, you know, is considered baseline. It's supposed to be the cleanest air in the world. And the air that travels there has not touched land for some time. And so they can use it as a kind of barometer or a baseline for global levels of CO2 and what background atmospheric levels are.
So if they were trying to measure it somewhere in the Northern Hemisphere, you'd have massive land masses with multiple cities. And so you'd get condensed air that's more indicative of that particular region.
Yeah, you'd have higher levels of city-based pollution.
And so from Cape Grim on the northwest of Tassie, you've got massive ocean. What is the next bit of land? Is it South America?
Well, this goes down to Antarctica, I guess. You look, yeah, like you're going sort of looking southwest over the Southern Ocean and also Bass Strait. Yeah. So you're kind of at this point of the oceans meeting there.
Yeah, right.
But if you kept going, you would get over to South America. And
yeah. But ultimately all the wind, like that's a long way.
It's a very long way. And it's so interesting to think about, you know, when you're there, like where is the wind, where is the air coming from?
Yeah.
You know, and what are they storing and who else has touched it? And
yeah.
And what has it seen along the way? You know, I love this kind of imagining of those things. So a lot of the exploration is around this kind of invisibility of this substance as well. And sometimes we can see it, or it forms in other ways through wind and particles and dust and things that you can kind of visualize. But ultimately it's invisible and it's all around us.
So you went down for 5 days.
I stayed just nearby. I wasn't living on site because of COVID restrictions. I wasn't actually able to go inside this station.
Oh, really?
I was wandering around outside like a creep with all my recording gear and peeking in through the windows every so often and freaking the scientists out. But no, they were very welcoming, and I've obviously been planning this for more than a year to go down. And yeah, they would come out and chat with me, and we go on walks and they talk about what different things did and what those sounds were from that machine, that piece of equipment over there, and what that radon thing did. And so they would come out and talk to me, but I wasn't actually able to go inside. But I will revisit Cape Grim over the next 3 years, multiple times. But I did go also to Aspendale, which is where they have a lot of similar measuring and analysis kind of equipment there.
Yeah. You often hear people talking about parts per million or how many tons of carbon dioxide. And to me, a gas doesn't have a weight. So I'm like, how can you have a ton of carbon dioxide? Like, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
Your visuals that you're using in your piece, there's the landscape, which is quite amazingly sparse and barren with just grass and sort of steep hills. But then you've also got these sort of bits of chrome and metal and gauges and scientific equipment and things like that, which is quite interesting because it's like the landscape almost could be primordial. And then you've got the highest level of human technology.
Because so quite antiquated as well. Some of that technology is very bespoke and, like, you know, 1980s and stuff in there,
sure,
as well.
So, yeah. Little graph.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Lines going up and down. Yeah. And little squiggles. And
to do that next to each other is like these two things that are constantly working together. you know, out of sight, invisibly kind of operating together to form this data collection, history, this knowledge of our action here on Earth. You know, I think there's this kind of beauty in both of those things that are kind of operating simultaneously to document, but also influence. Like the scientists that work here, they feed into UN Convention on Climate Change and systems and policies, and they feed back Australia's contribution to greenhouse gases back to the UN every year. And so it's this kind of not just a collection process, but it's about making change and influencing the way we do things. But I do, you know, I love there's this kind of like layers of human, machine, and environment, like animals, plants, birds, this interaction between all of these different things that are constantly working, constantly engaging, and obviously as well with the history and the layers of site, of colonization, of massacre, and yeah, it kind of speaks, it speaks to our times, I think, in terms of when did the Anthropocene begin? You know, some people say it's the beginning of colonization, you know.
In Australia.
Well, not just
anywhere.
In Australia.
Yeah. There's all sorts of theories about when we started going wrong as a species. Is it when we started farming and trying to control the land? Is it when we invented language and became cerebral instead of felt? Is it, you know? And I often think about, this is off topic, but I often think about how every time humanity has done something, it's in the name of advancement. And we've always thought we're making our lives better or the world better. But cumulatively, we've gotten to this point of mass destruction because of all of our advancements. And it's like, how far back do you go to stop that? Like, if we had a time machine, would we like be like Zeus and say humans shouldn't have fire?
Yeah, that's right. And we can't even imagine really what life would be like now, knowing what we know and having what we have.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It's really hard to imagine, isn't it? Is there anything else you want to say about this particular work? I think the soundscape is interesting. Tell us a little bit about the sound, and we'll have some samples of that in this podcast.
Yeah, well, the sound is made up of field recordings from both Cape Grim and Aspendale. So there's a lot of wind, a lot of natural sounds, the ocean, but then also the birds, insects, cows, and instruments that are constantly at work on both of those sites. So there's this kind of layering of sounds. But also I worked with one of my collaborators, Linda Dement, who has manipulated some of those sounds, that some of them form a kind of breathy sound. We're constantly breathing and these things are constantly working, and so there's this undertone of a constant breath that plays throughout. And I also collaborated with another musician from Cold Hands Warm Heart in Melbourne named Genevieve Fry, and they're working on another part of the soundtrack, which will be at the festival. So it's still kind of, there's quite a lot of layers of sounds, and I've also been given access to marine recordings, so from other scientists who've done like whale recordings and seal recordings and all these other kind of marine animal recordings from big voyages, and they've been extremely generous with their recordings. So some of those sounds are also part of this big, rich, layered, like, soundscape.
And the waves crashing.
Waves crashing, and also we've got this geophone. You can put it in the earth and it records infrasonic sound and sounds that kind of come out as felt rather than heard. And, yeah, so there's quite a lot of sounds going on, and it's a lot of subtlety in it, which hopefully will be able to be heard or felt.
And so people walking into the Good Shed, you're going to set up this amazing array for the projection of the video to go on to. Tell us a bit about what you're planning.
Well, I was given these weather balloons from the scientists I'm working with from CSIRO. They've found this collection of weather balloons. Actually, I saw this video from a voyage into the Southern Ocean of somebody releasing a weather balloon, and it was the most beautiful video that I saw. And so I'm going to do something with that. I'm going to make a new one. But I watched this weather balloon, this person holding a weather balloon, and it was so windy on the ship. It's like blowing around like crazy. And then, of course, it gets released, you know, and they've got the sondes attached to it, and they can measure the atmosphere from wherever they've released it. And I was like, weather balloons, of course. They're such a huge metaphor for, you know, global times. And then I asked the scientists if they had any. And he found me this big pile of weather balloons from the CSIRO from the 80s that were obviously not going to get used anymore. And I was like, I wonder if I can project onto weather balloons. And the ones they gave me were orange, so I'm not sure if I could on those ones. But I have since purchased other ones, so I'm going to set up a few weather balloons and project onto them to kind of use as a surface.
Yeah, so, cool.
Mm.
So weather balloons are kind of like, what, big?
They can go up to 6 metres in diameter.
So 6 metres in diameter.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Or bigger. And they're, what, silver?
Or just clear
white?
Latex, these ones.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And do they biodegrade, perchance?
No. There's actually a discussion about this.
Yeah, right.
They're made of latex, so...
Yeah.
I mean, there is a discussion about making environmentally friendly ones.
Yeah.
At the moment. But obviously some people just find weather balloons on their property or on the beach or something.
Or they're just in the ocean.
Yeah.
Floating around.
Yeah.
Oh, yep. If only the people listening could see the discomfort on your face.
Well, it's been talked about, you know. It's like this scientific process that also potentially causes harm.
But I think you're absolutely right in that is quite a good symbol in that case of what it takes for us to accurately measure and prove that climate change is human-induced and we really need to act now. And what it takes to do that is actually in itself not innocent of harm, you know. But it's in sort of, we have to pay some prices, I guess, or accept some, you know, to use war speak, collateral damage, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's always some level of compromise, isn't there?
And to live with no use is not necessarily what we're, like, not using anything is not necessarily the end game here, is it?
No.
We're just in excess beyond belief. Yeah.
There's a conflict between human rights and planetary rights, which
is
where the ethical conundrum lies, I think, for many. And which is where books like Donut Economics is trying to resolve that. Have you read that?
No, I haven't.
It's a great book. I'll lend it to you.
Thanks.
It's an economics book. She's basically talking about our entire way of life and how we need to consider when we're thinking about what we're doing, either as a country or as a human being, an individual, the centre of the donut is human rights. So how can we maintain a certain level of living so that humans are safe and happy and have freedom and are not harmed? But there's another level of where we don't want to exceed, which is to what point of damage to the earth and to the ecosystems and stuff like that. It's a good concept. She doesn't exactly say how to do it. She just says, we need to think about this.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say about the show coming up? How about how it sits in your larger thesis and what this moment in time is and this exhibition is in terms of the bigger picture of your explorations?
I think this is all preliminary kind of investigation, and I work really well by responding to place and responding to site and responding to people who are talking about their work and their history and their story. And for me, that's a huge part of this research is trying to understand, you know, to have conversation with scientists who've been doing this work for a long time. It's really kind of subtle way, care for the earth and care for all of us in this really beautiful but hidden way. And, you know, the land is doing that constantly as well. And I'm kind of really interested in just different ways of feeding back these kind of processes to have this bigger conversation that we're talking about here. And the work will evolve in many different ways through other forms, not just video and sound. It'll be lots of different things, and I think that it's the kind of process of research which will help me know that. But I guess the big questions are around, I guess, what we talked about at the beginning, around the role of art in this conversation and how to use it as a place of discovery, of understanding, of access, you know, access into these ideas and not shutting people out from them, and how it forms one part of a bigger story.
So let's talk a bit more about your other work as your history as an artist and a photographer and filmmaker and whatever else you've done, and how it's played in with your sense of activism and justice and on different levels. So is there a moment, or is there something you think back and you go, oh, that's when I really started to think this is what I want to do with my life? Or have you fumbled along and figured it out? You seem pretty like you decide things and you you've been on this track.
Lots of fumbling.
Yeah. But,
well, I think there's been a few moments, and I think coming from a kind of documentary background, really, you know, when I first started doing photography, when I was kind of in my late teens, or I did it in my early teens and in high school and stuff. But when I was like, I want to do this, I was like, I want to be a photojournalist. I want to kind of travel the world and meet people and respond. And that's the way I'm going to engage. And I want to use my photography to kind of learn about the world and also talk about social justice issues. And then I think getting involved in the anti-nuclear movement in Australia, to use my work in collaboration with others and in collaboration with campaigns and activism, I kind of started to see that there are obviously big power issues in relation to photography and imbalances of power around how stories are told, how images are framed,
who's holding the camera
and who's being shown and who's not being shown and how that story is being told. And, you know, this is a big question around the ethics of photography. Like, it's an ongoing conversation. And
we saw it just during COVID. A journalist went down to a beach, and from above you can see that everyone is socially distanced, but he took it with a particular lens that foreshortened things and made it look like it was a super crowded beach.
Yeah, manipulation of truth, and that's huge, you know, ethical conundrums of photographic practice and still big questions. Yeah, and the topic of the Photo 2021, which is a festival of photography on right now in Melbourne, is truth. It's still an ongoing conversation around... Yeah. What is photography in a time of post-truth? Still a big question. But for me, when I was in my late teens and I was like, okay, I'm working with Aboriginal communities and social justice groups, and I can see that there's a potential problem here, and how can I do my best to undo those dynamics and undo those relations and make it more collaborative and make it more relational? And, you know, there were kind of questions that made me stop wanting to be a photojournalist and, you know, more kind of work within different formats. So collaborate with others who are doing sound, or collaborate others who are doing video, and collaborate with community members who are part of the story. And yeah, I think that was one moment. And I think I saw some work when I was traveling in Israel and Palestine that really spoke to me. I think it was by Lida Abdul. And it's just this kind of beautiful way of speaking about war, but it was so not what you'd think about when you're thinking about war. It was like these kind of young children who had tied strings or ropes to a plane that had been either bombed or had fallen from the sky as part of a war. And they were kind of playing with this plane through this.
It was their playground.
It was their playground. But it was like this imagination that they were living within this kind of zone. And it was like, this is how you can speak to these issues in different ways. And I think that was another moment for me, which was like, how can I talk about the things that I'm interested in through different means, through different ways of engaging with these stories? It's not just about saying something is something, and yeah, then that's how you should experience it, and that's what we should be told. And I think that kind of pushed me onto a journey of going, I want to explore these things, and I want to find different ways of telling stories and engaging with these issues.
That was Jessie Boylan talking about her artwork for the Castlemaine State Festival called The Smallest Measure. Her work at Cape Grin will continue, and you can follow her on her website, the link of which is in the episode description at saltgrasspodcast.com. My name is Alison Hanley, and that is all we have for this episode of Saltgrass. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram, and please subscribe to our email list to get reminders and updates about the show. Go to saltgrasspodcast.com for all back episodes of the show. And of course, subscribe to Saltgrass on your favourite podcasting app. This program was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au.
And Mark here again to round out the episode. Recording from my car on a rainy day in Auckland, Tamaki Makaurau, Aotearoa. And I just wanted to thank Alison so much for sharing this beautiful episode with us. You can find out more about her show and the artist Jess in the show notes. And I just wanted to thank NARM Melbourne-based artist Tom Day for the use of some of his music through this episode. And a special thanks to Matt Wicking of the General Assembly. Now, we like to end Artbreaker episodes on a full piece of audio if possible. And while I could have asked Jess and her collaborators for some of the sound recording, they actually decided to reach out to Matt Wicking instead, as he and his band, the General Assembly, are guests I've wanted to get on Artbreaker for a long time. So this would be a lovely intro to a future episode down the track. And Matt, through his work at CSIRO and his music, have made a beautiful track called Return to the Bluff at Cape Grim. Now, this is a shorter instrumental version of a longer piece called Return to Cape Grim, which you can find a link to in the show notes from the amazing full-length album Vanishing Point. But this short instrumental version does a great job, I think, of summing up how I feel at the end of listening to this episode and gives me some time to process and digest it. So thanks again to Ali, Jess. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of Artbreaker, please consider sharing it with a friend and letting us know what you think of it. You can reach us at hello@climactic.fm, and if you know any great artists out there engaging with the climate crisis, please let us know. We're always looking for great guests for Artbreaker, and also looking for collaborators to work on the show with us. Thanks, and enjoy this track from the General Assembly.
Saltgrass.
Listen to all episodes of Turning the Goldfields Green at saltgrasspodcast.com.
The Climactic Collective.